Welcome to a Single Serving Podcast. I'm your host, Shaney Silver. I started this podcast because whenever I saw content for single women, it was about dating, how to date better, how to survive dating, and I know that we deserve more than that. So I created this podcast to change the way being single is seen, discussed, and felt, and I'm so happy to have you here with me. I hope you'll also consider joining the Facebook group for this podcast. It's become a really supportive community full of people sharing stories and encouraging one another and actually meeting up in real life too. There are three main ways that you can support this podcast. The first is simply share it. Share it with someone who needs to hear it, share it with your family, share it with your friends, anybody who could use a change in perspective when it comes to being single. The second way is you can rate and review this podcast on iTunes. It takes 2 seconds and it's a huge deal that really helps podcasters get more visibility and continue to do their work. And then the third way is you can become a patron of mine on Patreon. Patreon is a platform that helps independent creators earn money for creating the work that people enjoy. So there are multiple tiers that you can join, but my favorite one is a $5 tier that comes with an extra bonus episode of this podcast every single month. So there will be a link to it below. Check it out. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining me. Hello, my lovelies. Can you hear me? Can you hear that I'm now speaking into a microphone again? Doesn't it feel nice? I'm delirious. I'm not used to having an adequate recording setup. Sorry, guys. I'm so happy. I'm so happy that my technical issues are resolved. I am back on my microphone and recording in somewhat crystal clear sound for all of you. I just had the most fantastic conversation with Lindsay Goldwert, who, you ever meet somebody who, like, if you could choose them as your sister, you would? I feel like I would have chosen her and it would have worked out very well for me. It was a fantastic conversation. She and I have been following each other on Twitter for a while and interacting on Twitter for a while. So, you know, I love a Twitter guest. And we talk about money. We talk about money. We talk about power. We talk about dominatrixes. We talk about, you know, a lot of quarantine feelings. It's a long episode, so get comfortable, strap in, pour a drink, whatever you want to do. But this is a great episode, and I am asking her a lot of questions that came in from you guys, from the Facebook group, and we're just kind of shooting the shit and keeping each other company during this very isolated time. So this is a lovely treat for me to record, and I'm very happy to share with all of you. I hope everyone is doing well and staying safe, staying healthy. And as always, if you have a second to leave a rating and a review for this podcast, it really helps the podcast grow, which helps the podcast continue to exist. Another way you can support the podcast is by sending it to a friend who might need to hear it or a family member who might need to hear it. And then a third way is, of course, joining my Patreon. There is a bonus episode once a month of this podcast. It is a solo episode that I release through my Patreon. It is at the $5 a month tier, and that contribution from you is so appreciated, and it goes to allowing me to do this, essentially. So I want to say a huge thank you to all of my patrons for supporting me and for just sort of letting me know that you like and appreciate what I'm doing. It means a lot to me, and I thank you all very, very much for that. So like I mentioned, this is a long episode, so I'm going to shut up and get started with it. I hope you guys are doing well. I'm so excited to be talking to you on a microphone again. You have no idea. So I will go ahead and get this started. I love you guys so much. Thank you for listening. I'm very lucky to be able to make this podcast for you, and I never forget that. So thank you for listening. I love you guys so much. So hi, Lindsay, how are you?
Hi, thanks. Such a pleasure to meet you, finally.
Same. I mean, honestly, it sounds like a weird thing to say, but this is like how I make friends in the apocalypse. I just invite them to be on my podcast and then I have new friends, which is great. So hi, nice to meet you.
Hi. Yeah, I've been spending a lot of time talking to the cat. So yes. A person is better at this point.
A person is so much better. Like, not that mine isn't great company. It's just that, you know, 3 months in, it's a bit limiting. It's just a little limiting. The conversation is a bit shallow. We need to go a little deeper here.
Absolutely. And it's all food related. Like, if I feed him, then he'll keep me company. So I'm feeling very used.
I feel very one-sided. So used. I've just discovered that the only way, like, I can't get the cat groomers here during quarantine, obviously, because it's not safe. So I have to do so much more maintenance on this long-haired Swiffer duster of a cat that I have. And so, but she doesn't let me brush her. She attacks me when I try to brush her. I have discovered that I can brush her
if she's eating while I do it. But now she won't eat unless I brush this bitch. It is endless.
Amazing.
Endless.
Amazing. That is what a diva.
You have no idea. And as she ages, she just gets worse and worse and worse. But anyway, enough about my feline. Tell everybody who you are and where you live and what you do for a living.
Sure. Hi, my name is Lindsay Goldward. I am a writer and I live in Queens, New York.
Yay. So we're not that far apart. I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in Bed-Stuy.
Nice. Yes. Yeah. I mean, Sunnyside, Queens, lovely, weirdly bucolic part of the city.
Amazing. Maybe I need to look into that then, because nothing has made me crave green surround more than being locked in concrete for 3 months at a time.
We've been kept out of all the parks and stuff, but there's some green space nearby. Queens is great. I'm a fan. What can I say? It's the sensible borough. I call it the 30% off borough.
That's awesome. So yeah, I guess that my next question is, how has your quarantine been? Which is a new question to the podcast, but I'm going to keep asking it because I like finding out how other people are riding out the storm.
So it's interesting. So I have, I wrote a book that came out, which I'll talk about in a second. It came out January 23rd. And so I had a little while. I was expecting to go on to plan a tour and do all these things. So when I came back from a trip to LA, where I thought I'd, you know, get started there and just do some readings, I came back on March 1st. So I was on a plane on March 1st. And then once I landed, a lot of my friends started getting sick. And so it took, so I like to say that this is, the Q1 was excitement. Q2 is denial. Yeah. and eventual sad realization that the year is not going to be the year I thought it was. Quarantine has been okay. My husband and I get along pretty well. It's been hard to get work done. I've had to really change my whole career plan. What I thought was going to be booking myself on engagements and doing all these different things. And none of it's happened. The tour was canceled. So I've had to really pivot to figure out ways to make some money during this period of time. So that's been hard. I miss my neighbors. I have a very sweet little street where I know all the business owners, and they're starting to open up again, but it's been rotten for sure. So I can't complain too much. And all my friends who got sick, are all well.
Oh, thank God. Recovered. That was my question. I'm like, how are your friends?
All my friends got sick between March 1st and March 30th. Wow. So, yeah. So I would say I had about, my husband thinks we got sick, but in February, but I don't think it was, I think it was just the regular flu. But I would say about 9 of my friends were sick.
Wow.
And 2 of them, one of them pretty seriously. And my friend's husband was in the hospital and my friend lost her dad. So it's been very real to me in a way that I think for some people it's not quite as real because it hasn't touched their lives so much.
Yeah.
So it's been, but once my best friend from high school, once he recovered and he didn't have to go to the hospital, it changed my whole point of view on life. And I was like, okay, I'm ready to tackle anything. My friend is safe. I didn't know what I would do if anything happened.
Oh God. So, my best friend in the world, her husband is a lung doctor in the ICU in New Orleans.
Oh my
so
God.
He's been caring for these patients. He actually got COVID so badly that he himself was hospitalized, and it was the most terrifying weekend.
I can't even imagine.
All of our lives. It was so scary. It's just a completely different, it shifts so many parts of your perspective. It really does.
It does. And what's interesting is that I always watch the way people shop and how people sort of spend their money and how people act when they shop. It's just something I do. And the supermarkets now, as I think, you know, there's not as much, people thought there was going to be all this scarcity, that people were hoarding paper towels and hoarding toilet paper. People were filling up their carts and things were running out, and they were just more people shopping. And that made everything worse, you know? So in everyone's efforts to make the virus easier for themselves, they were probably infecting more people because there were more people on top of each other in a closed space, like, you know. So it's been interesting to see things go down slowly. So when I go grocery shopping now, it's just mellower because no one's in panic mode. What did you buy anything? Like something that was like, in case of emergency, you know, we have this. Did you do anything like that?
Well, I'm naturally a prepper anyway, because I've kind of always been, I've learned behaviors where I feel like I need to be prepared for things. I think a lot of it comes from when I was a kid. Like, I just always like to feel like what I need around me so that I'm safe and pretty comfortable is always here. So I've always had just a ridiculous amount of toilet paper in my house. I've always had emergency water. I've always had emergency lighting. Huh. Always had a go bag, all of that. But it's different stuff that freaked me out. Like I don't know. I was doing regular grocery shopping, but every time I would do my regular grocery shopping, I would always buy non-perishable things that I had never purchased before, ever. Like my collection of canned goods, which I do use, but like there are just so many more non-perishables in my cabinets than there used to be. Just, I don't even know why. It's like, it was almost like a compulsion to make sure that if I couldn't go to the grocery store for the next few weeks, that I would be okay.
Absolutely. We did the same thing. Feeling.
Yeah. It was very odd.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been, so the weird things I bought Carnation Instant Breakfast, like the powdered breakfast.
Hey, you know?
You know what? And I got to tell you, they're not bad.
I have been so excited to talk to you specifically about this. For those who don't know, you are in the money space, the financial space, and that's why we're chatting today.
Yeah.
Can I tell Absolutely. You that 2 days ago I paid $8.79 for like one canister of disinfecting wipes?
Sure.
It was the first time I had seen them on a shelf since the beginning of March. And I was just so excited, but also running low on them. So I was like, well, I need them. I'm going to buy them. And I asked the girl checking me out, how much are those? Because it's one of those grocery stores where they don't label prices on anything. So you get to the register and you spend like double what you would at Trader Joe's. And
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she's like, it's $8.79. And every part of my sensible, very budgeted, very responsible financial brain was like, are you fucking kidding me? But then the like prepper in me was like, I don't care. Just put them in the bag. Just go. Just take them and go.
Yeah, so there's a lot of price gouging out there. I think one of them, I read somewhere just now that one of the mask makers says is keeping a list of all the people that have been price gouging and inflating prices. It's you know, it's the laws of scarcity, you know, like people jack up prices. I remember during and they shouldn't do that, but at the same time, you know, everyone needs, you know, that's just the law of economics, I suppose. But I remember this is a long time ago, but in 2003, we had the big blackout in New York, and it was wild. And just people had to like get rid of their merchandise, but also people needed things. So people were selling like a pack of two AA batteries for like $10, you know, because people needed things for their flashlights, you know, and this was like this flash sale of some people being able, because they're also losing money on all the bodegas were losing money on all of their perishables, you know, so they were like, well, we can't, all of our ice cream, all of these things are, you know, our beer's getting cold, everything. So it was just it was fascinating watching people in New York just go bananas, because New York is a city of you can get everything you want pretty easily.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways we're not used to, we don't have a car that we can, you know, fill up with stuff from the supermarket, you know, we just sort of, you know, shop as we need sometimes, but we don't have the space, you know.
Right.
It's been interesting. So I used to work at an app called Stash. I was their editorial director, and I learned a lot from them. You know, I'm one of these people who was like a creative writing major, like with very, you know, not interested in money or economics or anything. And then sort of later on in life, I developed this very bizarre interest, which has been really cool. So I really try to look at everything like a regular consumer, because I'm not an expert, and I do try to look at how things change. And I try to use a lot of anecdotal data, which means like I look around me and I see what's opening up. I see who got their loans. I see, and I ask business owners like, how are you doing? And they all, you know, and because I love to interview people, you know, they talk to me and they go, oh, we got our loans. You know, we were really worried. Now we have this much runway. But we're worried about this. Like my friend owns the yoga studio on my street, which he built with his own two hands. And then he built another location on our street. I have like, you know, and it's like droplet city. Like, what is he going to do? Even though he got the loan to keep things moving. And he has a whole neighborhood full of beloved followers. Like, how is he going to be able to do what he's doing safely? So he has to navigate more than just the financial aspect of things and paying rent. He also has to worry about insurance. Like, there's all these things that we don't think about as patrons, that that being a business owner, when people are closing their businesses, it's not just because they don't have the money to keep them going. They may have the money, they just don't have they just have maybe burnt out. They're like, it's not worth it. The insurance, it's not worth it dealing with, like, you know, with land. There's things that are at play for business owners, especially food business owners, that I can't even, I don't know how people do it. I'm so impressed. Every small business owner deserves a medal.
Honestly. And I really hope that this time in our lives is such a one-off that it doesn't discourage people from following their passion and from creating these businesses that they want to create. I really hope that this doesn't deter people in the future from opening the restaurant that they wanted to open their entire lives. Like, I don't want this to be a deterrent, but it's hard to see how a global pandemic hit particularly the like entertainment, food and wine restaurants, all of that, like a freight train, just absolutely stopped everything. It's so crazy to me. And it's also, can I tell you something that I've noticed? Like, since that happened, I have so much more money. Now that I am going out and living the life that I want to live in the city that I'm willing to pay rent to live in, that's not happening anymore. And all of that money that I used to budget to like go and live out in the world and do things is just being saved, which is so insane to me because I mean, obviously like I would gladly spend it out there in these like local businesses that I've loved for so long. And it just all of a sudden is like, is Brooklyn even worth it? Is it worth it for me to pay this rent? Is it worth it for me to live here if I don't have access to everything? And these are just like random thoughts that are really like in my low points, because I know that things will eventually return to functioning again. Maybe not normal, but like things will function again. But it's hard not to think like, what am I doing here?
Of course. What's the city without the city?
Oh my God.
I mean, that's otherwise you're just living like in an overpriced dorm, you know, with people of all ages, you know. And it's, you know, a lot of my friends, especially my friends with kids, are leaving. It's a lot of people are looking at the rents they're paying and looking at the life around them, and suddenly, you know, they've been thinking about it for a while. It's not this like pandemics, they snap. So that's how you start to appreciate, you know, nature or having a backyard, you start to appreciate all these things for the places you fled to, you know. I'm not ready to leave the city yet. I still very much love living here, and I've been living in New York City since I'm 21, you know, so I'm not ready to leave. But yeah, you really see your life without the places you love. And I've been telling everyone that I miss being alone among strangers.
Yeah, right? It's a different kind of vibe. It's a different kind of alone. Yeah. It's like, this is so strange.
You're never really alone. If even when you ride the subway alone, or if you're having a cup of coffee by yourself, you're never really alone. And that's, you know, if you're kind of a thoughtful person, I mean, I can be very outgoing, but I can also be very introverted and be happy alone. And that's what New York is. You walk around by yourself and you're alone with your thoughts, and you could stop in places and you can have a whole day sort of doing nothing, but it's a great day with yourself, and then you get to people watch. So there's all these reasons why you live here. But it is true. I haven't been spending, and I've been trying to limit all my online shopping. I don't really need anything.
Where are we going? What do we need? You know?
Also just shopping, you know, just spending money feels good. Like hitting that button, that like click to buy button, it actually, it signals in your brain like a pleasure. You get actual pleasure from doing it, in the same way you have a bite of chocolate, or in the same way someone flirts with you, you get this rush of good feelings and serotonin, you know? So there's a reason why if people were to do a lot of online shopping now, it's because there's a loss of pleasure in our lives, you know? So even though we should say, oh, I shouldn't be spending money right now, there's a reason why you might feel that compulsion to do so. So that you can think, so if you're looking to think about why you're doing it, there's a reason why, you know, and then it's up to you to say, well, maybe I should find my pleasure, you know, maybe doing something else, you know, like making ugly art or something, which is what I've been doing, like making very terrible art.
I've been cooking a lot. I love to cook, and I feel like it's one thing that's necessary anyway during a quarantine. So that's been bringing me joy, just being creative in my kitchen. And also, and I have to stop. Like, I decided a couple days ago, like, this is getting out of hand. I keep buying books. And I read, but not at this pace. Like, this is ridiculous. I read, my favorite thing to read is memoirs of famous women. And I have Diane Keaton and Debbie Harry sitting on my desk, but I'm not done with Samantha Irby's book yet. And I have to finish that because it's the best thing in the world. If you haven't read it yet, it is amazing. Yeah. It's wow, no, thank you. It's so good. And then I'm reading yours as well. Like, it is just, there's so many books that are like piling up on my coffee table, such that my cat can no longer sit on it. It's like getting out of hand.
It's comfort. I'm surrounded by books too. And I have so many. There's a bookstore in LA called The Last Bookstore, and they were doing something really sweet where if you send them, you know, $50 or whatever, they will curate a box of books for you. They'll surprise you with a box of books. So I sent them a little bit of money, and I said, I want some high art, low art, like pulp crime. And they sent me a massive box of books, like used and new, like every single era from the 40s to the present. And it's been great escapist reading. And it was just like, it was just such a joy. But at the same time, like we all are suffering. I shouldn't speak for everybody. A little bit of a lack of focus. We're all looking at our phones. Our nerves are very jangled, and it's hard to focus on our work and doing things for pleasure and taking care of ourselves. Everything feels very uncertain.
And very, like, a lot. Even small things I found feel like a lot. And I had to, like, right the ship a little bit in terms of nerves and anxiety. I realized, so I wake up at, like, 4 in the morning or 4:30 in the morning. It's a weird thing. I accept it. It's who I am. But when I wake up, I'm at my desk by 5. And I was realizing that I was looking at a screen from about 5 a.m. until whenever I went to bed. Wow. And first of all, my eyes don't need that. But second of all, like, my like emotional state and mental state, that's just too much screens. So I started taking either from 3 to 4 or 4 to 5. I make a cup of tea and I make myself sit in front of my window and just look out at trees and sky.
That's great.
For an hour, just to calm and not be on the phone and not be stressed and not be freaking out on Twitter, which is how we know each other.
Yeah.
Like, not to like panic for 1 hour, just sit there and look at a tree. It sounded like a silly idea that I was just like, oh, let's see if this works, but it fucking does. Like,
of course it works.
So helpful to just do nothing for an hour. But again, that's a luxury I have, right? Like, I'm not an essential worker. I'm not out doing a million things. I'm not I'm freelance, so I get to decide my own schedule. And then I start freaking out because like, I am so lucky that I don't have to do any of these things. And like, that gives me anxiety. It just is layer upon layer.
You think about people who are living in the Great Depression, what their lives would be like if they had Twitter, if they had 24 hour access to all the awful things that were happening around them, all the layoffs, all the labor strikes, you know, all the starvation and all the unrest. Like, how would they, like, how would my grandmother have coped? People would just have, like, it's, how would people have lived? So the amount of anxiety we're giving ourselves, we're overloading our brains with, really is ludicrous. You know,
anything to talk to your grandmother right now? Because I would.
I would. I know my grandfather is still with us, and I actually owe him a phone call. But he grew up. He was pretty young during. Yeah, I mean, his thing was like, we were poor. You know, it was the Depression. You know, and it's everyone's attitudes from coming out of poverty are really different. You know, my dad's attitude is very different than his sister's attitude. You know, everyone. People, my grandmother, on my dad's side, was really horrified that we bought like vintage furniture. She's like, why would you want anything old? Like, what, you can't afford new? And I said, no. I said, we really like it. We're friends with these people in our neighborhood. Like, it's really cool stuff. And she just was like, okay, oh, I think I get it. Like, you know, but it was just, she was so worried for us that we couldn't afford new furniture. And it's just everyone's attitudes are so different, and it's because of how they were raised, and it's because how, I always say, tell me about your family and I'll tell you about your finances.
Yeah.
But it's sort of true, but also I'm just very interested in how people grew up and what their attitudes were, because it doesn't mean because you grew up poor that you're going to grow up great with money or bad with money. A million things have to happen, come into place for you to have the feelings you have about how you spend and how you save.
Well, let's get into that. Tell everybody about your podcast, and then I'm going to get into some financial questions that came in from this audience.
Sure. So I have a podcast. It's a little bit on hiatus now, but I'm hoping to get it going again in the summer. It was called Spent, And I got the idea of doing a funny money podcast and interviewing comedians and interesting people about their financial mistakes and what they learned. Comedians are great because they have no filter. I did stand-up comedy for a brief period I forgot, 5 years actually. I had stopped in 2017 because I had to get a job and be serious for a little while. But yeah, it was interviewing comedians about their money mistakes and their craziest money stories. And people really liked it. People like to laugh. People like to hear a story about someone who messed up worse than them and is still alive. And I talked to a comedian, Andrew Collin, who made and lost $250,000 in just a few months. He spent it all. It's a great episode. It's a great episode. And then I spoke to this other guy, PD Diabru. He's one of the best hosts in the city. He talked about his journey to wealth and his eventual arrest for white collar crime. And he talked a lot about what it's like to suddenly have a lot of money when you come from nothing. We talked about medical bills. We talked about being homeless, you know, and people have, there's a way of sharing these stories, putting all your money into a venture. This one comedian talked about putting $4,000 on his credit card to fund his own one man show. And so the last few episodes I did were actually about sex and money. And I interviewed a adult film star, and she was fascinating. She talked about royalties, that she talked about, you know, it's harder for her and people who sell adult merchandise because they have to pay their payment processors are much higher interest rate for them. So it's not the same as selling a painting or like a shoes. Like, they have to pay a lot more to get their payments processed. And it's really frustrating. She was amazing. I spoke to these two dominatrixes. I talked about marketing their work and kind of setting the price. I'm like, how do you set a price on a service, on a luxury service? I try to find a money angle in everything I do. Good stories are essential. It's got to be a good story. I don't want to just interview a CEO. I'm not interested. I got to hear a good yarn. I got to hear
done with CEO interviews. I don't want to hear from the CEO. I want to hear from somebody who works five levels down from the CEO to find out what's really going on at the fucking company.
That's what I'm interested. That's really great that you say that. If it's going to be a CEO, it better be someone at a very early stage CEO, someone who's like still in the shit, somebody who's like, dude, you don't even, someone who could really talk and say, you don't know what it's like out there to try to sell, you know, sex toys to, you know, like you don't know what the problem, you know, you want someone who could still be real and not say all these measured, like, well, we've realized we've come full circle. Like, I don't give a shit if you come full circle. I want you at the beginning of the circle. I want you when you still have no idea where the end is.
Right.
Because that's when people can learn. You know, I get inspired by people who fail and then win and then fail again. I don't get inspired by people who are just winners. And that's the difference. Some people want they want someone who's always inspiring. They want someone who never messes up, or their mess ups seem kind of human, you know, but I like people who are more like me. They're like, hey, I'm just as much of a screw up as you are. I'm like, if I can do it, you can do it. That's what I like. That gives me hope.
I do too. When I see all of the, and I think they're fantastic, by the way, but when I see like female founder panels or female founder stories, I want to hear from the people that are working for them. I want to hear about the full team.
100%. Yeah, I've worked at startups. It's like they get trained to not give real talk, and everyone is desperate for real talk. I was once on a panel. It was a personal finance panel, and it was mostly for women of color. And I was struck by the difference between the attitudes on the women on the panel that night and a lot of the other kind of female founder panels. There was so much more real talk and the crowd was so much more engaged. The crowd was like, I have a question. Like, should I be investing in real estate or not? And normally people would be like, well, like they give all these hedgy answers because people always say diversify your portfolio, but they don't tell you where to buy or what to, they don't just tell you what you should be doing. And on this panel, Nikki Merkerson, who is CEO of Paragap, said, listen, I'm going to tell you where I would look right now. And everyone like whipped out their notebooks and they were like, you want to look in certain parts of Philly, you want to look here, be careful with Baltimore. Baltimore has all these issues. And it was like, it was just so amazing to be able to really talk, because there's something that it's like, I'm above everybody else. I'm just going to say, listen, it's all a journey and we're all going to get there, you know, and it gets this like sanded down reality where just, you never, it's just, why am I hate that stuff. I hate like all that like bullshit thought leadership. It bothers me. Like it actually makes me physically ill, which is the one part of startups, the people who should be the most honest are the least honest. I think that's part of, you know, that whole Silicon Valley tech culture is that you always have everything, you always have to spin everything into a win.
Yeah, and but then like 5 years later, somebody talks to a reporter and the real story comes out. And I'm like, yeah. Why is it always such a shocking real story of what a hellhole that startup was? Why weren't we always hearing how these, like how the sausage was made?
Yeah. I mean, I was a journalist for so long. I mean, I worked at so many different places. I worked at the New York Daily News for a while. And it was like, I'm very used to frank talk. Like this place is going down. I'll tell you exactly why, you know? And it was, and so to go into a place where people are very, we're just more closed now, then it was considered wrong to point out the flaws of things.
Yeah.
It was very hard for me to get used to. Because the job as a journalist is like, gotta pick things apart, but to sort of see where the flaws are, see what people aren't telling you.
Yep.
And if you do that when you work at a startup, people see you as kind of a negative influence. They'd be like, oh, like he's not really, he's not really a team player. He's kind of negative on stuff. But you,
oh my god,
the person,
if the truth is seen as a negative, you have a problem.
But there's something. There's just this positive attitude that people think like it's just like, yeah, focus on the wins. Focus on the wins, you know. And it's very, and there is something to having a positive attitude for sure. I agree. I think that that's pretty good. But this all goes along with privilege too, being like things are going to work out because they always work out. Because I'm a rich white dude. Like, how could they not work out? Like, so it could be their own experience of stuff. Like, anyway, I don't know. People put on a big show. There's a lot of fake till you make it, which is very hard for me to do because I wear my heart and my feelings on my sleeve. So I don't have imposter syndrome per se, but I do try to be honest with my feelings. You know, I'll never say something's a journey. I'll say it's been a roller coaster, highs and lows. It's not a jerk.
For sure. I'm super transparent about all the work that I do and all the ways that it gets made and that it's difficult and I'm doing things alone and often not paid to do them and would like to be someday. And I'm going to get there because I'm working really hard, but I'm not going to like falsify how I got there to like this like throne of success that we hold up without showing you how you got there. Like the real ins and outs of how you got there.
So I got really upset. I was on LinkedIn and I saw someone wrote on LinkedIn, you know, you can't quarantine the hustle.
Oh, Christ.
And I was so angry when I saw that because it's like, you know, the onus on Americans to just to bootstrap and take on more themselves that you're a failure, that like you lost your job. Like, wow. Like, well, you should have had three jobs like me. You should have always had different, you know, streams of income. Right. So I was that's so depressing that there's somebody telling you it's like, well, you should have been working harder. And that's part of what makes America so depressing is that you're expected to do everything yourself. And if you don't, it's your problem.
Right when all of this started, there was a push to like make the most of this time and to not waste it and to like be super innovative and like make the most of all of this. And I'm like, it's okay if you can't do anything right now. This Absolutely. Is fucking terrifying. You don't have to be super productive right now, which is getting slowly like harder for me. Because this is going on a very long time.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's not any less scary that I can't safely leave the house. Like that's still.
Yeah. I mean, people say like, what did you do during this time? I'm like, I didn't get COVID. You know,
right?
My full-time job was like not getting sick. You know, I paid, you know, trying to take on some new work. But yeah, I didn't, you know, I guess because I live in Queens, I live like 20 blocks from like the hottest of the hot zones, you know, I'm like, yeah, I think because I somehow managed miraculously not to get COVID and hopefully I won't get it. But like, that's a full-time job is like he's paying your rent, not getting sick. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's all you can do. And I'm trying to right the ship. I'm trying to do more freelance work. I'm trying to take on some more consulting work. I'm trying to navigate the present while navigating the future. The future is very uncertain. So you really just have to give yourself a lot of slack for just moving. And we're in a time of like big political unrest, a time of very big social unrest. It's very difficult for you to hustle during this time if you're a sensitive person who feels terrible about what's going on today, you know, in all the cities across America who want to be allies and just feel just disgusted with the way things are and hopeless, you know, that is very debilitating no matter who you are. And also watching people have fun during this period of time is hard. It's like everything is difficult, you know, like it's like, what do I want from other people? I'm like, I want to be left alone. It's like, wait a minute, I am alone. You know, it's like, I don't know what I want.
Everything's up in the air. Like,
I just want to be alone someplace else. That's what I think. I want to be alone someplace else.
I want to be alone someplace with a backyard. And that is the very first time that that has mattered to me. I have never, ever, since I moved to Brooklyn, gave any thought to leaving it. Until now. And I'm like, I see people with their backyards and they can just go outside, out their own front door and into their own private backyard space, whatever size it is, and their feet can touch the grass. And I've never, ever thought that that would matter to me until it became so unattainable. Yeah. It's insane. But I want to make sure that we get to questions that came in from my Facebook group. But overall, there was one repetitive question. And I like this a lot because in my opinion, and I don't know if you agree, but in my opinion, the best gift that a single woman can give to herself is a savings account. Because I find a lot of comfort and confidence and freedom in a savings account. I find that I am able to have far more confidence in making my own life decisions and have far more confidence in making my negotiation decisions with clients and with work because I have a savings account that matters very, very much to me that I nurture because it's what keeps me feeling like I'm in charge here. And the way that I got there was by like almost stealing from myself. Like I always, speaking of like talking about real shit, I put 1/3 of every single paycheck I ever make in my savings account. As just a general rule, 1/3 of it goes away no matter what. And I'm freelance, so there's no tax ever taken out of my paychecks or anything like that. So that's how I built up my savings account over time. And the question, the most recurring question that came in from my audience was general like budgeting advice, like how do I save money or how do I stop spending money? That was the most like recurring theme that came in. And I don't know how to answer that because I've always been very rigid and anal with money. And like, I found saving that money and like squirreling that away to be a pretty easy thing to do, but I know it's not for everybody. I know that this is not like it's a personal thing. It's almost like a personality trait. Like there are just some things that we do out of habit and some things that we don't, and that's different for everyone. So I wanted to find out from you what advice you have for people who want to get better at budgeting and want to get better at saving.
Okay. So one thing that I've learned is automation is easier than doing things manually. So say you get your paycheck and you get, say it's your 2-week paycheck, you get $1,500 every 2 weeks. Then you have to remember, it's like, okay, I'm going to take $400 and I'm going to put it in my savings. And you do that and you're like, oh my God, now I only have $1,100 left. And the whole thing is very fraught because you start to have feelings. And there's a term for that. It's called you feel that loss. It's like the pain of paying, even though you're paying yourself, right? So a lot of people that I respect recommend automating your savings, meaning like set up every time you make that deposit, it automatically will go into a savings account. This is a lot of places will do this for you that you don't have to have like a fancy app or anything. So if it's done that automatically, you won't feel that anxiety of losing it. It just sort of magically floats away. And that's a great way to build up your savings without remembering to do anything. Another thing that I liked, I used to work at an app called Capital, which I think is still around. They worked with the economist, Dan Ariely, and he found that if you give your savings account or accounts like a name or a goal or something, like if you just have like savings account, like it's easy to pilfer from it. You know, it's easier of like, oh, like I have $5,000 there. Like, what if I just took like 400 out this month, you know? And it's because it's kind of a nebulous name. If you put like, if you gave it like a name, like wedding or something, like you don't want to steal from your wedding fund because you can imagine a wedding, you know, or you don't want to steal from your trip to, you know, your trip around the world because then you can have a shittier trip around the world. I think, but even if it's just a regular emergency fund account, I like what you were saying about because you have that this money, you don't have to take jobs you don't want to take, you know, so that's really important too. So you can even say like I, you know, this fund makes it so I don't have to do X. Like you can just put like a feeling toward that money, and put stakes around it. You know, and I think that so that you're not just growing it for the sake of growing it, you're giving yourself less to spend for why bother? Like, all I'm doing is saving, and for what? And I have no money in my checking account, but I've got $5,000 in my savings account. Why don't I just spend the savings? If you have to give it some higher stakes, so that when you look at that number, you feel good about it, versus look at the number and seeing what you don't have in your checking account.
I also find that the first time you experience and feel the benefits of what you've saved, it reiterates what a good job you did, and you want to do it more.
100%. It was really funny a few years ago, this writer whose name I don't know, came up with the idea of this fuck it fund. Yeah. which is so great, because what it was saying was it's an emergency fund, but she found this sort of feminist spent on it, where saying this money means that I can walk out of any relationship. I could walk out of a bad roommate. I could quit a job, and I will be okay. And that resonated with so many women, because that suddenly is not just a rainy day fund or an emergency fund. That means we've all had to get out at some point. And having that money means that you can do it on your own terms, and you don't have to go back home. You don't have to you don't have to ask friends for money. So it's really an independence fund. Mm-hmm. So I would say automate it, so you don't feel it leaving your account, and it'll just build up much faster. So that's the best advice I have. And also give it some meaning. Don't just be like savings, but say, I'm doing this so I never have to do X, Y, and Z, or I'm doing this because I want to X, Y, Z. So I would definitely assign some meaning, a name, a photo, whatever you need to do to make it feel very real to you. I'm very big on, giving things names and faces, because it helps me develop a feeling about it. So so that's what I would say. And in terms of budgeting, Elizabeth Warren was the one that came up with the 50-30-20 rule, or 50-30-20 rule, which not a lot of people know that she's a pretty expert budgeter. And, it's all about so there's a few things you can do. There's your needs and your wants, and then there's, your savings, right? So your needs are got to pay rent, you got to pay your bills, there's your student loan payments. And so there's things, it sounds very boring, but it is sort of helpful to just even do this for a few months, and just write down on a piece of paper, what are your fixed costs? And this sounds very boring, but it's actually really helpful. So I would just clear off your desk and just do it. What do you got to pay rent? Got to pay your student loan payments. Got to pay your credit card bill. What's not going to go away month after month? And then you say, what are my variable expenses? And then how can I trim those down? It's like, do I need I have Netflix, I have Hulu, I have my, I have HBO Go, I have my gym. You think about and you just look at your credit card statement and be like, ugh, and you start to see all the stuff, and you say, how can I trim these back? How can I trim these back? And I think that's the difference, is you want to lower your variable expenses, because your fixed expenses aren't going anywhere.
Right.
And this is just a basic budget, and that's just something it's just what you have to look at. And then you start to see all the stuff you're spending on that you really don't need. And it shouldn't shame you. It's just a picture. It's a snapshot. And then you say to yourself, and that's how people start to save money. It's not that it's exercise, eat less, exercise more. It's not like that. It's just an examination of where our money is going. I deleted all the shopping apps off my phone. I found that has actually helped me save money. I have certain rules for myself that I've actually written down to help me get my savings back on track. But yeah, I would definitely say that just take an honest look at yourself and just say, what will always be the same? You probably have $2,000 worth of fixed expenses. Don't feel bad about them. Life is bills, Yeah. And then, but you can't, there's certain things then you have to look at yourself and say, because Susie Orman, I know everyone loves her, but she shames people for having their $5 cup of coffee every day, right? That's her big thing. And I think that there is wisdom in that, sort of. But I think you have to look at the bigger picture, and that's where feelings come into place. So every morning for work, you go to Starbucks and you get a $5 cup of coffee, okay? And it's it's the only bright spot of your day is this one cup of coffee, okay? And if you don't get it, you're miserable all day, and you just, it puts you in a bad mood. Okay. Same time, the larger question isn't about the coffee. It's about your job. The thing about money and about all these things is all these things are about your feelings. So it's not just about the cup of coffee. It's about what's happening in your actual life. So by assigning every time you purchase something, just ask yourself, like, how did I feel? Did I need this? And don't feel bad about it if you didn't need it. Like, just erase all that stuff. Just say, I used to buy a cookie every time I left therapy, you know? And the question was not about the $350 I spent on the cookie, but the question was, why do I always feel like I need a cookie? Like, why do I always feel like, what am I feeling that's so shitty? And that's the larger question. And then I stopped buying the cookie. So yeah, there were savings, but I also solved a problem. So feelings and finance are really important, and it's very, that's my big battle cry. So I think when you start to think about your variable expenses, don't feel bad about what they are right now. Just go through them and say, what was I thinking? What was I feeling? And then you do want to lower them because that's how you save more. It also makes you feel more powerful as a person.
I mean, you guys rewind and replay everything that she just said in the last 5 minutes of our lives.
Oh gosh.
I found recently, and I have Marie Kondo to thank for this, I found that when I really went through everything I had and decided what was bringing me joy and what wasn't and getting rid of stuff and keeping, I was also re-informing myself of what I actually owned and what I already had and did not need to buy. Because I think sometimes we forget. It goes in the back of a closet. It goes under the bed. You don't know you have it. I just went through all of the products in my bathroom and good Lord. Like, I don't need to buy skincare for the foreseeable future. I have enough like travel size skincare products because I used to travel all the time that I can just use now because they're there. And it's like, I like reinforming ourselves of what we already have and 100%. What's already at our disposal as a method to saving money as well.
I 100%. I always say to myself, I was sad, so I shopped, you know, and we've all done that, you know, and I think that when you do go through, I went through something similar where I did a massive overhaul of all my clothes and I gave a lot of it away, to thread up or whatever. And I wrote about this in my book. I wrote about how going through your closet is so painful. First of all, you see all the money you spend on stuff that you didn't wear. Or stuff that you wore that you hoped would fit but didn't fit. Stuff that you bought that reminds you of a bad time in your life. You know, stuff that you kept even though because it was expensive and you felt and you were embarrassed that you spent money on it. Your closet is like a photo book of good and bad memories. So getting rid of things is very hard because you're entering into this minefield of tangible feelings. So it's when we say like we're shoving things back in the closet, it's because we don't want to. This was me. I'm not saying you. This is like Lindsay's story. I didn't want to deal with certain things. I didn't want to deal with the jeans that didn't fit. I didn't want to deal with the dress that I wore to that wedding that makes me think of this friend who I don't speak to anymore. Like I really like, and when I bagged it all up, I thought about all the waste of money and how I could have spent, I could have gone on vacations. I could have done all these things. And it really hurt. It really hurt. And it made me feel really embarrassed. And then I got out of the house and I said, today is a new day. And I said, I'm not going to shop like that ever again. And I do not shop. I will never. And I made a list of rules about what the kinds of things, the kinds of clothes I will buy, the kind of shoes I will buy. I said, I will never. And I'm sticking to it. I wouldn't buy things on flash sales just because they're cheap. I will not like spend to save it was a 40% off. So I bought it. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, you know, 40% off a sweater you didn't want is still, you're still spending money on something you didn't want in the first place. But that's all like all this great psychology about money. But it is all very painful to go through your closet and to see you feel a loss too. When you put all that stuff in bags, I just saw piles of money and I just saw piles of sadness. I think I had a good cry. I was really mortified.
I was too. I was so mortified that I had given so much of my money to Zara, who has not lifted one finger in the name of size inclusivity. That was a hard lesson for me to teach myself. And I haven't bought a single thread of Zara since.
Well, I saw like things in all these different sizes. And then it's like, I had like 8s, 10s, 12s. I think I had a 14 in there for when I was going through a really, and I just was like, I don't even, so I tried everything on. I looked in the mirror and a lot of it was all, but a lot of it was just stuff I just couldn't deal with. Everything's like a metaphor for me, but it was not being able to cope with a lot of feelings in my own life, you know, and it's just easy to stuff back in the closet, whatever. It's like a metaphor, but it is true. That's emotionally. So going through your stuff and, you know, there's, you know, some, I know I used to go to Sephora when I was sad, you know, like I am from a long line of ladies who like makeup, you know, and there is something about purchasing a beautiful, bright color and putting it on and feeling more beautiful than when you came in. That's not crazy. I started to think to myself, you know, I have that color. I don't need it. Like, it just, and I started instilling that discipline myself, because sometimes, like, you do need something. It's like, oh, I ran out of the shampoo. I love the shampoo. Sure. I'm going to buy the shampoo. And then that's great, because you're buying something you love and you're going to use it up. But I think that I switched my mindset on beauty and shopping and all that stuff because of this horrifying purging experience. And I don't know if it was a Marie Kondo experience, but it was also just, it wasn't about joy. It was about pain. Yeah. It was about wanting to live a more honest, it was wanting to face myself, face the past. You know, I turned 40 and I was like, how can I be this better person now? How can I have learned? How can Lindsay learn and be the better, you know, have a phase two, hopefully out of three phases, have a phase two of my life that's better than phase one. And going through all my stuff was a massive part of it. And it really made me want to puke. Yeah. Seeing all the stuff, you know, it was not easy. Facing yourself and all the stuff you spent your money on is gross and painful, but it is the best thing I ever did. I changed the way I spend. It changed the way I feel about myself. What is worthy of putting on your body? Like, really? Like, is like, do you deserve better? Like, do you like everyone needs a bra, right? I mean, like, if you buy a nice bra or a shitty bra, whatever bra you want to buy, it's up to you. Some people don't give a shit about lingerie, but going to H&M because you're just having a horrible day and you buy like a bunch of stuff, it's like, that's what's going to be in your closet for a long time, unless you need it or that's all you can afford. Just ask yourself why and what purpose it suits. And if you say, I need this strapless bra for this dress I'm going to wear, I'm probably going to use it again, for fuck's sake, buy it.
Yep.
It's an item. If you're shopping out of like, if you say you're walking out of work and you're having the worst day, and you're like, God, and you, you know, you see the store windows, whether it's the mall or whether it's, you know, you're living in an urban area, and you're just like, ah, oh, that would just be so nice. Just get some, to get like a, something like a necklace from Anthropologie, or to get something cute from H&M, somebody kind of jazz up my wardrobe. Or if it's all based on your feeling and not need, mm-hmm. you know, just try to resist it. Just be like, it's not going to make things, it's not going to solve the problem. That's the question. If you hate your job, this item is not going to make your job better. Nope. If you have an interview tomorrow, buy something nice. You know what I'm saying? That's the difference. Like, and that is so hard to do. And I say this as someone who is like feelings extreme. I am the most feelingsy feelings person who ever feelings, but it's discipline. But when you walk out, you feel power. And that's the thing is taking the power back. Don't let your purchases take the power. You're in control of your money. Your money is your tool. It doesn't have to leave your wallet. You're the one in charge.
The motivation for spending and the purpose of your spending, I think, are two things that we can really tailor to ourselves. Like, you can, also, I wanted to point out that, like, when you're going through things and when you're evaluating how you spend, what you have, what you don't need, I feel like information about yourself that will help you financially emerges while you're doing that. I don't think that you have to stress about what am I going to learn from this process. I think it's going to become clear to you very easily. I don't want anyone to be scared about like delving into their fixed expenses or their variable expenses or their own closets. Like, I think the lessons will emerge on their own pretty easily. I didn't know that I was buying... I used to buy clothes because I thought that they were what I was supposed to wear. Mm. And the change I had to make was I am only allowed to buy clothing and shoes and makeup and everything from now on that makes me feel comfortable. If 100%. I don't feel comfortable, it can't come in this house. It really can't. I have to shop and dress for comfort, not for what I think is going to present me as stylish, because that doesn't work for me personally. So like, if it's not comfortable, it can't come in the house. And I have to tell you, for the first time in my life today, I'm wearing bike shorts. I have never owned them. This is a brand new purchase for me. And I have just found out that all they are is little leggings, and they're fantastic. They are fantastic. I am so excited by them. I woke up, put them on, and I bought another pair a couple minutes later because of logistics with laundry. I need more than one pair. But that's, you know, they're comfortable. So they're going to be in my house now.
It was really funny. So I wrote this book where I interviewed dominatrixes about their philosophies on personal power. And there's a whole chapter about dressing for power. And I spoke to this woman. She is a couture latex designer. Her name is the Baroness. She has a store in the East Village. She's one of my favorite people. She changed my life. She's very eccentric and very fabulous. And she sat down with me for like 2 hours and she just talked about what it means to dress for power. And has nothing to do with like power suits, or has nothing to do with like walking with an attitude, which is, I mean, it's good to walk with confidence, but she said it has to be comfortable. You have to feel comfortable in your own body. You have to feel like you have to feel that you're exuding power. It's not that you want to know what people think of you. It's like you're putting your power out into the world. Like when you walk in and you're like if you're tottering on high heels and things are too tight and you feel your shapewear, you're going into a room already feeling very defensive because you're all wrapped up and you're tight. You're sweating. I know I'm sweating.
Me too.
But if you figure out but you think about the person that walks into a room and they're comfortable, they're wearing the right size. Like they're putting something out there that's so much more calm and confident, and people want to be around that. You want to attract people to you based on the real you, not just the you that, you know, magazines have told you to be. So what you said about, you know, not projecting a certain, you know, not dressing how other people tell you to dress, or how Instagram tells you to dress, or how whatever tells you to dress. You forming a personal style, whatever it is what makes you feel like comfort is sexy. People who feel effortless in their clothes are sexy. And I always thought of comfortable as like giving up. You know, like I'll just wear like you know, my clogs and sweatpants. Like, no, like all my clothes are comfortable now. They fit. You know what I'm saying? Like maybe they're a size up, but they look great. So I'm not sucking in my stomach. I just walk out and I feel fabulous. And so comfortable doesn't mean slovenly. It means that you're not thinking about your body and your clothes. Your body is just there. It's fabulous, you know?
And I've just learned that whoever I end up with someday is going to have to find bike shorts very sexy. Like that's just going to have 100%. To be his truth. Like
absolutely.
There's no other way to do it.
All people care about is confidence. I'm telling you, if like I was once out with, I mean, not that it should matter what guys think, because if you think you look good, guys will think you look good. Not that it matters what they think, but I was once out with some guys and there was a woman in a band. She was playing, she was dressed like a 1940s hobo. It's the only way I can describe it. Like a 1930s hobo. She was playing like the washboard on her stomach and she had bells on her hands. And they all thought about how cute. They were like, she's so cute. Like she's so interesting. She was just because she was so happy. And she was like, this is what I'm doing. I'm a musician that plays weird 1920s ditties and I play the washboard. And then and she was wearing a weird hat. And they were just like, oh my God, she's so cute. Like, oh, look at her. And it's like, this is her natural thing. She's a natural eccentric and she's living her life. And all these guys are like madly in love with her.
Amazing.
And you just think about like all these girls were all fabulous dressed up. Like, oh, we want to look at the girl with the washboard. So all that matters is that you're yourself. That's the key. I swear it's true. Take it from Aunt Lindsay. I swear.
I mean, I have to believe you because I can't waste any more money on clothing that doesn't make me feel comfortable because I know it's just going in the donate pile anyway. So yes. Like, what is the point of having it there? I think, you know what, the real like proof to myself of this whole like comfort vibe that I've adopted will be when I can get my photograph taken in an outfit that I styled myself for the purpose of comfort only. I've never once taken a headshot or a professional photo that I liked. In fact, I don't use them professionally or publicly because I hate them so much and I've paid for all of them to be taken. The photos I use are all photos I've taken of myself because that's the only way that I feel comfortable. And I want to be able to like style myself in an outfit that I find purely comfortable and have somebody take my picture and then I see it and I don't hate the way I look. That I think will be a crowning achievement.
You're going to do it. It happened to me. I did it. I took headshots for the book and I wore a wrap dress. I'm a wrap dress freak. They don't have to be expensive wrap dresses, but I like wrap dresses. They make me feel really feminine and sexy and powerful. You know,
I'm praise show, DVF.
Yes. You know, and I have like bargain basement versions of DVF also, nice, you know, nice. But no, it's like I'm very covered up. It's like to my knee and they have like long sleeves. So it's very professional, but also shows a little bit of the décolletage. So I feel very powerful when I wear without feeling overly sexualized. I wear a blazer and t-shirt. Like I felt that's what I wear every day. And I had nicer hair. But yeah, I don't know. It's getting older. Getting older is the best. You learn stuff. Everyone's afraid of getting older. But oh my God, like this has been the best time of my entire life. Like I turned 40 and I am living. I'm living for it. Like just like know that things are going to get better as you get older. Like the best part of getting older is how much you learn about what you spent, what you gave up, what you the mistakes you made, like eventually, if you think about it, if you become more, when you become more thoughtful about your purchases, you become more thoughtful about the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And you start asking yourself why you do things, and that, don't punish yourself. Don't say, you know, whatever, just be like, huh, like I did this because of this reason. Like, okay. You make a little check mark. And next time you do it, you just give it more thought. Being up in this, it's hard to do, but it becomes second nature after mm-hmm. a while. And you say you're putting the power on yourself. And there's so many things out there that just, they make it so easy to spend money. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars spent on Instagram and all these things that make it spending money. How much money was spent on one click shopping? In the old days, it was 10,000 screens before you could buy something online. Like you had to like one for your address, one for this. And by the time you got to the register, you were already bored, you know? And now it's just so easy. And that took tons of work for Amazon to do. That's why Amazon is too easy to spend your money on. You don't even know where your money went because you don't even feel it because it's too painless.
And Shopify now is so effortless. Like if you want something and you add it in your cart, the next screen is your address filled in, your card filled in, everything. Yep. All you have to do is click purchase. And I'm like, this is dangerous.
It is dangerous. And you just have to think, you know, just instead of being like, oh, I spent too much, but just think about all that they're trying to take money from you.
Yeah.
Like you have the power. It's your money. Make them work for it. You know, make them, you know, I wrote this book about dominatrixes, which is really funny. And taking the power back in a situation is really important because it's not just about power play with people. It's about power with the things in life that want to take you down or want to like put you, it's like I have to spend money on like you know, like take my wallet, you know. It's No, that's not really how it is. Like you're in control of your wallet. And if you're not sure, if you're feeling the need to spend a lot, like take a walk around the block, you know, like figure out what you need to do to put the power back in yourself because it's your money and it's your credit card and your money is power. And it can, don't let anyone take it from you ever, whether it's Sephora or whether it's like someone pressuring you to buy the bottle of wine for dinner. Like it's your fucking money.
It's your fucking money. Before I let you go though, tell me about your book because I cannot wait to read it. Oh. I'm so fascinated.
Did you have any credit card? Do you have any credit card questions? Because that's important too. I don't want to make sure that if that's important to your listeners.
Yes, there was one credit card question. Yes, I did have one listener that wanted practical advice on how to best use credit cards. Like how can we use them to our advantage?
Okay. It's important to have credit. It's important to have credit. It being credit worthy helps you get an apartment later on in life. It helps you get, you know, you can buy a home, you can rent a car, all these things. It's very important to have good credit. The best way to use your credit is to use it a little bit every month and pay it off. You know, and look at the benefits of the card. Like sometimes a card will, it's good for like a big appliance or something. Like it'll give you like more benefits than if you paid cash for it. The best way to use credit is to pay it off every month. That is the best way to use credit. The best way to use credit is to not, you want to make sure, like if you have a $5,000 limit to, if that's your credit utilization ratio, you want to keep it low. So say you spend $200 a month, you know, for like, say what you say you pay one of your bills on your credit card, you know, to say, $200 out of a $5,000 limit is keeping your credit utilization very low. And that's what credit card companies want. They want to make sure that you're not at risk of defaulting. You're not at a risk of, you know, them having to chase after you. You absolutely, the worst thing, and we've all gotten messed up with our credit cards at some point, is interest rates on credit cards are very, very high. It's important to pay down your credit cards if you do have debt. And don't feel bad. It's the life makes credit card debt happen. So the best way to, so that's very easy for me to say, you know, yeah, like, you know, don't spend a lot on your credit cards, but it is good to use them. They are a tool. Look and see what the benefits are. I wouldn't, you know, it's, you know, see if cash back is worth it for you. See if points and miles are complicated. Make sure you have them explained to you because some points and some miles, I struggle with points and miles. I'm not an expert because sometimes the miles for one company don't match up with one credit card company, don't match up with other points miles. Sometimes it might not be. So unless you're like a person who travels all the time for work, I wouldn't worry so much about that. Think about what you want the credit card for. And if it's just like, I want to establish basic credit, that's terrific. You know, keep your purchases low, pay your bill every month. If you want to pay down your credit card, there's a few ways to pay it down. Some people say the snowball method. So say you have debt on three credit cards. And the first thing I would say, if you can, is to roll over as much of the high interest debt onto a zero interest credit card. or it's deferred interest. Usually it's zero interest for like 18 months and then it jacks back up. If you can get that credit card, they're harder to get these days. If you can do that, that's great because it kind of stops the clock on some of the interest. So that's a good thing to do. It's a good tactic. And then some people suggest paying off the card with the least amount of debt on it first so that you feel that sense of accomplishment. It's like, oh, sweet. I paid the $1,500 off that visa. Phew. Okay. And ideally, you know, then you say, I'm on to the next one. And ideally, so you feel that sense of accomplishment as you keep going, because it gives you a sense of feeling in order too. So if you are in debt, that is a good way. There's other ways of doing it. To me, I think that's a way that feels like it would encourage you to keep going. Okay. But yeah, and just know that, and if you're struggling with your credit cards now, because a lot of our credit cards are, we're putting stuff on credit now because we're out of work. Mm-hmm. There's a million reasons why people are leaning on their credit cards right now. And that's just a national, everyone knows that right now. So if you call your credit card company and you say like, listen, I'm going to be, I lost my job or I had a pay cut and I can't pay my bill right now. Like, how can you work with me? They will work with you. They will suspend late fees. They might give you a little bit of a delayed due date. So if you're underwater with your credit cards this year in particular, don't keep it to yourself. Don't be ashamed. They just want your money, you know, and if you call them and they work out a plan with you, that's good. That's a good thing. They know that you're working with them, and it's when you start to go into default and you start ignoring your mail. That's when things are very grim. So just, if you're worried or freaked out, don't be scared, get in touch and they could work out something for you that'll help you with fees or help you with something else. That's really important. Also this year, if you want to start managing your credit and you want to just take the plunge, which you all should, you can check your credit. You can request a credit report anytime this year without dinging your credit. This is something that this is an unusual thing this year because people are so on top of their money and flipping out. So when usually you can only request your credit report, I think once a year. Now you can request it anytime if you're worried about fraud or you're worried about, if you want to look at your credit report, just make sure it's all correct. That's a very important way of managing your credit. You know, when we bought our apartment in Queens, I had to look at my credit report and it was really weird. You know, there was some stuff on it that I was like, what's that? What's this? And there was, and it was interesting to look at it. And I was like, well, that shouldn't be there. That shouldn't be there. I think there was a misspelling of my name on one of those. So it's not going to be full of dark secrets. Ideally, but it's important that you look at it because it is the snapshot of what people think of you financially.
And what's the best resource for checking your credit?
Oh my God. You can look on Experian. Sorry. You can look on, there's a million different credit agencies. You can look on Experian. There's any credit agency, TransUnion. You can look on there and you might be able to do it through Credit Karma. If you look up a government resource for how to request your credit report. So make sure it's via a government agency, so they'll direct you to the right place. But yes, this is something that was reported on all over the news. Okay. So if you look on NerdWallet or NBC or CNBC, everyone's linking to the same site. So that's a good thing. Your finances are very important this year and you have to do everything you can to protect them, and don't be scared. All these companies are very large. They seem like monoliths and they seem like they're all against you, and you just have to take back the power and be like, no, you all work for me.
Do you think that the mindset of I don't want a credit card is okay?
I think it's important to have a credit card, even if you just literally use it for like $100 a month.
Okay.
You know, because it is, because you need to establish credit. Credit is very important for your financial picture. Okay. It is important for you to be able to rent an apartment. It's very important for you to be able to purchase a home one day. Credit is important. Okay. And I think that you should, I mean, that's the way it is right now. Who knows, it might change. I know there's other people are using like Quad Pay and Later Pay and all these other ways of paying for stuff because it doesn't really involve credit. You can pay for things over time just using your debit card, so you don't have to worry about credit. Everyone's very afraid of going into credit card debt, and that's not a dumb fear. It's a good fear. But I would recommend having a credit card and maybe just paying off. If you tie like one bill to, just have your Hulu bill on there, so it's just like $7.99 a month, you're establishing credit.
And like set it up on auto pay so you never even think about it.
And then you just pay it off every month and then you won't pay interest on it because you're just gonna pay it off every month. Just also look to see what the fees are. You know, like Amex has fees, some cards have no fee. Just make sure that you just want the most card you need, which might not be very much. But it is important to have to establish credit. And this is the way it is these days. And you don't have to, just don't use it very much. Yeah, just like put like two bills. Like if you just charge $20 a month on it, it's your credit. It's your life. It's your financial life. But credit is very important, unfortunately.
Okay. And for anybody who needs a little bit more financial help and resources for either for right now, for credit, for budgeting, for saving, for planning for retirement, and for planning for buying a house. Those are also really big concerns within this community. For people who cannot necessarily afford to hire someone to help them manage this stuff, do you recommend any resources for financial planning or management that are easy to access?
There's some really great personal finance books out there that are written by women. Women really run the personal finance space, even though it might not seem that way. I think that my friend Erin Lowry has a book called Broke Millennial. And she's in her early 30s now. She writes in this very approachable way. And she's very passionate about travel. She's not one of these like parsimonious, like don't spend anything, you know, retire when you're 40. She's very practical. So Broke Millennial is a great book to start thinking about your money with. It's very accessible and she's great. And I think she's a great place to start. There's another, so that's where I would start. I think she's great and you could follow her and she works with a lot of really great people. She's a great person to follow on Twitter and Instagram, and the people that she aligns with are good people. She doesn't work with people that she thinks are scammy or gross. So I think that I like Broke Millennial. I think she's pretty fantastic.
Amazing. And I will obviously link to this stuff in the show notes, you guys. So don't stress about writing everything down. But before we go, tell me about your book and what people can expect to read in there and get out of that book.
Yeah. So I wrote this book called Bow Down: Lessons from Dominatrixes on How to Get Everything You Want. And the funny thing about this book was I thought it was going to be a work and money book. I thought it was going to be a book about the dominatrixes are going to teach you how to like whip your finances into shape and how to make you like the dom of of the office. And there's a little bit of that in the book for sure. But I ended up really falling for these women and really kind of falling in love with their ethos on empathy, kindness, self-confidence, self-love, and open-mindedness. There's something about the way they talked. It changed my life so much about the idea of taking the power back from certain situations and not feeling so helpless. So all this stuff about money and clothes, all this stuff comes from the book. So the book is about, it's about sex for sure, about how to speak up for yourself in your relationships, how to speak up for yourself at work, how to feel good about yourself and your body, you know, and also just what do you stand for? Like, what are your personal values? Like, there's something I'm working on, another piece is based around the book. One of the doms I spoke with was, she said, you have to have a personal code of conduct. And she said that very off the cuff. And I said, can you tell me more about that? And she said, well, you can't expect if you ask your children to treat you a certain way, but you let your boss walk all over you, you're letting people treat you differently in different parts of your life, and it can get very confusing. You have to set one standard for yourself about how you deserve to be treated. And you can't let your boyfriend treat you like shit, but your friends, you have to really set one standard. And that really blew my mind. I had never thought about that. You know, then it made me realize how I expected so little from all my, from work, and how much I expected from my partner. And it just got me thinking about, what are my basic tenets? What do I need from other people? What will I take? What will I stand for? And that really got me thinking about a lot of existential questions. So the women I interviewed are fantastic. I admire them so much because they're small business women. They run a business. They are really, really interesting and smart. The ones I spoke to are a little more successful in the industry. You know, they're not working as much in the shadows as some of the other women. They're doing it at this point in their life because they make a good living out, not out of necessity. Some people go into sex work for very different reasons, but they were all very sensitive and they all had very, very interesting stories from the past. A lot of them were secretly very shy. A lot of them, you know, I related to a lot of them as someone who didn't want to live an ordinary life. I really fell for them, and I fell for how open-minded they were, how funny they were. I live to laugh, and I just, and they're, not all of them are feminists, but it's a very, it's pretty powerful to be in a room full of Doms. You feel a lot of energy, and you know, and when they say like, who's that guy, get him out of there, you know, and he's forced to leave, and it's just a bunch of women in a room solving problems, there's no feeling like it. So I don't think that sex work is for everybody. Even though Doms don't have like normative sex with their clients, it's still considered sex work. They identify as sex workers. I just never met so many cool women in my life. So it had a very big effect on me. So the book's a little dirty. It's got a lot of heart. And people seem to be responding to it. I feel so lucky. The women who I profiled, which is all I care about, they were very happy with how it came out, which is incredible. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it.
Oh my God, I cannot wait to read it. I'm so excited.
It's goofy and pervy and it's got heart.
Oh, bring it. I'm so excited. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to chat with this audience. There are, we like talking about money. We like talking about
anytime. The things that, like, deeply affect
us. So thank you so, so much.
My pleasure. Yeah, I'm going to be doing a lot more writing about money these days and writing about work and money in particular. So yeah, if anyone wants to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Lindsay Goldwert. I can't wait to meet you guys. I hope I get to meet you all soon.
Oh my God, yes. Is Twitter the best place to follow you and keep up with what you're doing?
I think so. Yeah, Twitter is kind of my main jam.
Amazing. So. I mean, same. Okay. Thank you 1,000 times for all of your very wise financial advice and for writing the next book I'm going to read once I burn through this Debbie Harry memoir that I am like dying to read. But thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to meet you finally.